I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Elizabeth Renzetti joins me now. She's the co-author of one of the season's best novels, Bury the Lead. We'll talk about the book, which is a great homage to the murder mystery genre, as well as the setting of the small town newspaper, which in this book is the professional home of our lead character, Kat Conway. Conway, who grew up in the cottage country town of Port Ellis, finds herself back working on the local paper, the Quill and Packet. I'll ask Ms. Renzetti about this character of Conway, why we're drawn to her, and what she represents with her professional experience, and the middle of life that she finds herself in with all its complexities. As the star of the local theater's play, Elliot Fraser, is murdered on opening night, Conway sets out to find out how, why, and importantly, who did the deed, as well as whether Fraser had it coming. I'll also ask Elizabeth about working with Kate Hilton, who was on this program earlier, and what to expect with this character in subsequent books. Elizabeth Renzetti is a best-selling author and journalist. Many will remember her for her many years as a reporter and columnist at the Globe and Mail. She's the author of the essay collection Shrewd, Awry, and Closely Observed Look at the Lives of Women and Girls, and the novel Based on a True Story. She's got another book out later this year, What She Said, Conversations About Equality. Visit ElizabethRenzetti.com for more. Bury the Lead is published by House of Anansi Press. We spoke about 3 weeks ago. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Elizabeth Renzetti. Ms. Renzetti, good morning.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us. When there's a moment early in the book when Kat is interviewing Fraser, Elliot Fraser, in his dressing room, where I guess it, from the first sentence, and I said this to Kate last week, you really get a sense of why you don't like Fraser that much. It's quite clear, even from the first sentence, that Elliot Fraser is not a good guy.
Yeah, he's kind of a blowhard, isn't he? He's kind of a pompous blowhard, and I think maybe, you know, partly that's his character, but partly that's what fame can do to people. You know, I've interviewed so many. I've interviewed a lot of celebrities in my time as a journalist, and I think sometimes like a wall can build up around people in which, you know, a lot of things are done for them, and they come to expect a certain level of deference and care, and I think that Elliot is at that, definitely that stage in his life, and it's something we kind of tease out in the rest of the novel, like how this entitlement has hurt other people.
So there's another moment in early in the book where our hero in the story, Kat, is interviewing a fellow actor of Elliot's, Declan. They're in a restaurant, and he calls Elliot a dick behind his back. And then he shoots a look at Kat and tells her not to write that down. Has that ever happened to you when you're profiling people, interviewing people, say?
Oh, yes. Many, many, many times. People will, if you're doing sort of a secondary interview around a profile subject, people will say, you know, they'll say things like, okay, this isn't for the record, but, or, you know, don't write this down, but, or, and then you kind of get their actual true sense of how they feel about that person. But they have to be discreet. In Declan's case, you know, Elliot is senior to him. He's the lead in the play, and Declan can't afford to antagonize him in any way. So he has to be careful. So he has to kind of hide and couch his real feelings. So I think, absolutely, that happens more often than not when you read a celebrity profile, or indeed a profile of anybody. You almost never get the unvarnished truth of what somebody actually thinks. You're getting the palatable, made-for-public-consumption view of how they think.
Yeah. I was telling you just before we started how much I'm enjoying the book and how much I'm fascinated by Kat as a character. I'm not sure if I like her, but I can't look away from whenever I read her in the book, whenever I see her in the book. She's such a fascinating, interesting character. Where is she in her career?
Well, she is, midway through her career. She's 45 in the book, and she's been practicing journalist for most of her adult life, and she had quite a successful career in Toronto, and then she changed from being a newspaper reporter to being a TV reporter, and then something catastrophic happens, which I won't spoil for readers here, but something terrible happens, and she ends up losing her job. So she's in a really interesting place when the book starts, which is a place she's not very happy. She doesn't know what's going to happen in the future. She doesn't feel comfortable. She's quite unsettled. She feels like her career is on the rocks, and she's ended up in this little town. And for a novelist, that's what you want. You want a character who's, you don't want to write about, it's hard to write about happy people. Mm. We want to be happy in life, but novelists don't want to write about happy people because it's tension and drama and strife and conflict that create interesting characters. And so she's in a place in her life that is quite full of conflict, and then we have to see how she uses her resources to resolve those conflicts.
And she's incredibly resourceful, and I can't help but think that inner conflict that she's contending with motivates her in this new job of hers, as well as in terms of how the novel unfolds in terms of trying to figure out what happened to Elliot Fraser.
Well, it's interesting you use that word resourceful, because that's often a word I use when I talk to young journalists, which is, you have to be resourceful. Like, it's not a job. It's a job for self-starters. It's a job for people who are able to be resourceful, to think on their feet, to be self-starters, to go out and kind of look for the information that they need. So that is one of her great attributes as a journalist, is that she, is willing to and able to pursue leads and try to find out new information, even though she's kind of also feeling this strife and this uncomfortableness with her new position at this small newspaper. She still has the instincts that she's always had as a journalist, and those being resourceful is sort of primary among them.
Yeah, and her personal life is also in a mess, and this, lights a fire in her in a way, doesn't it? That she has to.
Yes, she has something to prove, because she's had a bad divorce, and her teenage son doesn't like her very much, and he prefers the company of his wealthy father. And I think it's interesting. I think I've heard from, I myself am not divorced, but I've heard from other divorced friends who have kids and custody issues that often comes up, that one parent is preferred over the other one. And it's very hurtful to the parent who is not the chosen one, and they wonder how they can repair this relationship with their child, because the divorce is already painful.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, you feel like, oh my God, I might be losing my kid as well. And I think that's, again, very rich territory emotionally for us to explore.
The place itself where the book is set, Port Ellis, is such a fascinating place. I find it interesting because I've lived in Vancouver my whole life. A place like Port Ellis it seems like a great place to visit, but I couldn't imagine living there.
So there's this whole, you probably know this, but just north of Toronto, there's a whole, there's a few cottage countries which are quite wealthy,
right.
And they've become wealthy, places like Muskoka and the Kawarthas, and they've become more wealthy, much, much more wealthy in the past, like, 20 years, with the influx of new money and people who have come into the town, because they're very beautiful, the lakes are beautiful, and people buy up the properties, and it changes the nature of the town. So Kat is also looking at, again, this gives us some really lovely tension to work with, because she remembers the town she visited there with her when she was little. She stayed with her grandparents, and now it's a different place, and she's kind of trying to reconcile those two things. things, the, you know, the old money and the new, and, you know, where does the newspaper fit into all of this as well? So that was really rich territory for us to look at.
And because it's a smaller place, you know, smaller numbers, smaller geographically, the people's lives are so much a part of each other's lives, I guess, aren't they?
Yeah, so you get this wonderful kind of Melrose Place, you know, quality when you're all, that's one of the great things about either a mystery or even, you know, like a soap opera or something. You set it in one small place, whether it's an apartment building or a town or, you know, a ranch or whatever, and then you have, yeah, forced proximity of the people who are in the town, and their lives are all entwined, and they kind of are all up in each other's business all the time. Yeah. And this leads, in the town of Port Ellis, there's, you know, like a feud that's been going on for a century, and there's people who hate each other, and there are secrets, and there are, you know, various things that I can't talk about because it would give away too much of the plot. But, yeah, it's wonderful because it's not like you don't have the anonymity that you would have in Toronto or Vancouver or Calgary or Halifax, somewhere a bigger place. You know, so that was wonderful to play with.
Yeah. Other than Kat, as you're crafting these characters, how important is it that they're likable to you as the creator?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I wrote my first novel 10 years ago. I had a protagonist, a woman who a lot of people found unlikable. I like unlikable people. I find them fascinating. But you have to tread a very thin line with readers. They can't be so unlikable that they are off-putting to the reader. Mm. But what they have to be is complex. So they have to have a combination of what we consider kind of heroic traits, selflessness and compassion and things like that, and then the kind of negative traits that we all recognize in ourselves, selfishness and, you know, maybe a bit of cowardice or envy or these things. So you have to, when you're crafting a character, you have to make, like, nobody's all light or all dark. So you have to create people with shades who, you know, and you have to remember that they're working in concert with other people. So you have to play off the shades, not just within themselves, but within the group of people as well.
I was going to ask, as we're starting that last question, other than Kate, are there characters that you really liked being around as you were writing the book?
I love the staff of the Quillen Packet, the newspaper,
yeah.
Bruce and Amir and Cadence and Hannah, the summer student. I really, like, I think my love of journalism and newspapers and Kate's as well, really, you know, came through when we created those characters, because I think, maybe it's a romantic vision, but I tend to think at heart most journalists are quite idealistic and quite good-hearted, you know, obviously flawed in ways too, but I wanted to, and journalists often have a nice, funny, sarcastic shorthand that they use with each other, which is very, it's fun to write.
That's another great setting that you've created, that newspaper itself. The scene early in the book where we get to meet the publisher, the editor,
yeah,
and all the characters there is a fascinating place. I mean, there's these visions in my head as to what it looks like, how small it is, or how cluttered it is. By the way, I asked Kate last week when I talked to her about the name, the Quillen Packet, because it's a great name for a paper, especially one of these small town papers. Was there a paper that you had in mind when you were thinking about the name, say?
Yeah, I love newspaper names, like the Times-Picayune in Louisiana, the Craggan Canyon in British Columbia, or Alberta. Anyway, the Craggan Canyon, there's so many wonderful names out there, and there was a paper in Orillia in Ontario called the Packet and Times, which was a great little newspaper, and it was closed when its corporate masters closed it about 5 years ago, I think. Anyway,
regularly,
it was one of the more and more newspapers are being closed, and it's a very Ontario name because packet ships. You know, plied the lakes, and they brought mail, and they brought other goods through the lakes. So it's a very, it's kind of a historical name as well. I just thought it was a, it's a funny shout out to all those wonderful, you know, the Halifax Chronicle Herald, all those great old newspaper names.
Yeah, it's a great, this book is, well, it's dedicated to journalists, but it's a lovely love letter to small-town papers.
So.
Yeah, we know your work in the Globe and Mail, obviously, many years there. Did you ever work at a small-town paper?
No, and I almost wish I had. I had lots of friends who did, and they would have hilarious stories about, you know, having to cover, like, sometimes, you know, very tragic things, like there'd be a car accident on the highway, or sometimes it would just be, like, the most ridiculous kind of fundraiser for the hospital, like the mayor in a dunk tank or something like that. And and that appealed to me, that idea that you get to really write about everything. And I've interviewed people who, you know, work for small town newspapers and local papers, community papers, and they really perform such an amazing service. And you know, right now we're losing a lot of those community local news outlets. I will say a lot more are also springing up, but they tend to be more online and less actual, you know, sort of printed on newspaper. And that might be, you know, the future of journalism that we see, is that it's less dead trees and more kind of online. But it's still very valuable.
Indeed, indeed. When did you and Kate first meet?
We met, I think, about 7 or 8 years ago, so it hasn't been that long, but we immediately clicked and bonded, and I read her novels, and I loved them, and she's just a really, you know, she says this too, and I think as a therapist it's very interesting, you have to, you know, the way you choose a partner, a romantic partner, if you're going to choose a business partner or a creative partner, you also have to think about, like, how do your personalities mesh, and we're very fortunate in that we're simpatico with each other. Like we have similar kind of personalities, and that we're not morning people. We're both kind of laid back. And you know, it wouldn't work if you didn't like the person you were. You have to admire the person you're working with, but you also have to like working with them. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
Yeah. So you've both written novels on your own. Is it more fun working with someone else?
You know what? It's way easier. I'll say that. And yes, more fun. And I'm amazed more people don't do it, because it's, you know, first of all, it's hard to finish a novel. You get halfway through and you kind of sometimes lose interest. I know I do. And if you have a partner, you can't just abandon it. Mm-hmm. You have to keep going. And also, you know, it's just the case of two brains are better than one. There are two sets of ideas, two sets of histories that you're bringing, two sets of expertise. You know, I think we're seeing more and more collaborations, because writing is a very lonely business, and it's just a really positive way to work.
So both of your styles of writing are unique, and yet this comes together with a unique voice altogether. Does that take time to come to that or put that together, say?
Well, we both have a kind of, I would say, in our writing style, it's kind of wry. It's witty, kind of humorous, a little bit of a, you know, sardonic eye on things. So we did that. We both had that sensibility. And then, you know, we wrote a long outline, and then we would write alternating chapters, and then go back over each other's chapters and, you know, change what we felt needed to be changed. But honestly, when we were doing the second draft, I would sometimes forget who had written what chapter. Mm-hmm. It was pretty seamless. And then in the editing process, and with the help of our editor, Siobhan, who was wonderful, you smooth it out even further.
Yeah, it does come together in such a in one voice that's unique itself. I would think it'd be hard to figure out who wrote what.
Yeah, it really was, and you know, or whose line was what, or you know, whatever it was. Anyway, it was a joy.
So Kate mentioned when I talked to her last week that initially Kate was going to be younger. And I'm wondering what happened.
Kat was going to be younger. Late 20s. Uh-huh. And we tried writing it. We actually wrote about, I think we wrote, did we write half the book? I can't even remember. We wrote quite a bit, and but she just wasn't coming alive as a character. And then when we made her older and kind of gave her some of the struggles that we had had, you know, as women, as mothers, as working women, then she really kind of jumped off the page and became fun to write. And then we knew we were on the right track.
I can't see her as a younger character. I mean, I find her...
I know. Once, now that she's, like, fully alive as this person, I think, like, why did we even ever bother to do... But, you know, it's funny. That's writing. You learn to write by writing. You learn what your book is by trying to write it, and some things don't work, and then you're like, okay, that didn't work. I'll try it this way, and that, and then, like, oh, that works. So it really is, that is the process of writing a book.
And I can't help, I mean, as you know, I haven't finished the book yet, but I'm enjoying it so much that I'm wondering if we'll see Kat again. And Kate,
yes,
alluded to
the second book now.
And does it take place in the same place, or...?
Yes, it's all going to be Quill and Packet. And the mystery series we're calling the Quill and Packet Mysteries.
Uh-huh.
And so it'll be in Port Ellis and at the Quill and Packet. Although maybe in a future book she travels, who knows? Like maybe, you know.
Yeah.
We're hoping that this could be a whole series of books that we write for quite a long time.
And I asked Kate as well how she saw Kat in her head. I guess, do the two of you differ as to how you see her physically?
What did she say? I'm curious.
I think she said that I think the difference was how tall she was, that one of you saw her as sort of like Sigourney Weaver and statuesque.
Yeah, that's me.
And she didn't see her as that.
I do see her as... It's funny because even though we don't see her like as exactly the same person, I think we have a similar sense of, you know, what she is physically and definitely emotionally and mentally. But I kind of see her as a younger, maybe not quite so tall Sigourney Weaver, like a quite, you know, curly dark hair and energetic kind of thing.
Yeah, because I must say, even in this early part of the book where I've only seen her, you know, just a bit, how I see her in my mind, it differs scene to scene. But I see all of it now as I'm talking about her with both of you and thinking about the book. I guess that's part of how complex I see her and why I find her fascinating to look at, if you will, as I'm reading the book.
Well, that is really wonderful to hear. I'm so glad to hear that.
You alluded to a moment ago these profiles that you've written over the years of celebrities. Getting starstruck, because I mean, you know, you're probably a fan before you were a writer of a lot of these people, or not a fan, but I mean, you knew these people through celebrity and the sort. Does getting starstruck happen often?
I tend not to be starstruck by actors. I was starstruck when I interviewed Keith Richards. I was very starstruck because I loved the Rolling Stones, but I've been a big fan of him for a long time, so maybe there I was a bit starstruck. But I tend to be more starstruck by writers, and I've interviewed a lot of novelists, so somebody like, I don't know, Hilary Mantel or Ian McEwan or Judy Blume or Kazuo Ishiguro, somebody like that, I'm often starstruck by, because I just think they're, you know, they're geniuses. And, and then you don't want to seem like an idiot in front of those people. But actors, not so much. Like, I admire what they're doing, but I kind of don't feel like, you know. And in fact, when I see other journalists sort of fawning over celebrities, it's a bit embarrassing. And, you know, you think, oh, God, just go do your job.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is maybe a little bit of what comes through with Kat is she's a bit skeptical and leery about Elliot.
But she knows when to turn it on, though.
Yes, well, that's journalism for you. You kind of have to, You have to grease those wheels a little bit.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of yours, and so I couldn't wait to talk to you about this and this book, and I can't tell you how much I'm enjoying it. I can't wait for the next one and the next one after that. I so appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much, Joe. That's wonderful.
I really appreciate your time today. Thanks for this.
Thank you so much. It was lovely being here.
The website for more is at elizabethrenzetti.com. The book is called Bury the Lead. It's published by House of Anansi Press, and one of its authors, Elizabeth Renzetti, joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plantum.